Well, good morning. I'm glad to see the turnout considering the parties last night and the time change. So welcome to our panel on open access textbooks and learning materials. I'm Melissa Hageman. I work with the Open Society Institute Soros Foundations, and my work focuses on access to information in developing countries. Now, I'm very pleased to introduce our panel, which consists of some of the leading experts on open content issues. We're joined this morning by Eric Mueller, who's the Deputy Director of the Wikimedia Foundation and a former member of the Board of Trustees. As many of you probably know, Wikimedia operates Wikipedia, but it also works with a host of other collaboratively produced reference materials. We're also joined by Rich Baranek, who is an engineering professor at Rice University, and he's also the founder of the Connections Project. And Connections is an environment for collaboratively developing, freely sharing, and rapidly publishing scholarly content on the web. And we're also joined by S.J. Klein, who is the Director of Community Content at the One Laugh Per Child Project. And many of you may have heard of or seen the XO laptops, formerly known as the $100 laptops. And these are inexpensive machines which are being distributed in developing countries. Now, the format of the panel will have some questions and answers here at the beginning among the panelists to frame the issue and discuss the problems which have led to the creation of many of these open learning materials. And then we'll have questions, a time for questions at the end. So, Rich, if you could start us off,
sure.
Could you talk a bit about the problems with textbooks and why you created the Connections Project?
Sure. I guess I could talk from my personal perspective. Mm. So I'm an engineering professor. Any engineering professors here? Show my hands. Okay. And I teach in the area of signal processing, which is basically the math behind JPEG, MPEG, a lot of computer-based animation. And back in 1999, I realized that I was being increasingly frustrated by textbooks and by the standard way that we teach and that we learn and that we develop textbooks. I was frustrated really by four things. One is the fact that anytime you commit something, commit your ideas down into a textbook, you're disconnecting ideas in order to create this linear stream of 300 pages in a textbook, and you're not exploring all the possible avenues. And it's a lot of those avenues you don't explore that really are the things that get the students very excited. So I was bothered by the disconnection of ideas. I was bothered by disconnecting people and the fact that it was very hard for me to pull together, at least back in 1999, a community of people to bring different ideas and viewpoints as what it meant to do, in this case, engineering, and bring that to students from around the world. Because of this, I realized that if I were ever to try to do this and write my own book, the process by which we develop materials is absolutely glacial. Has anybody here ever written a book? Right? How long does it take to write a book? 5 years, 10 years, everybody's working on a manuscript, right? So the process is extremely slow. And even when you think in terms of this country's textbooks, it's going to take over a decade to get Pluto out of the science textbooks as a planet. And probably by the time we take Pluto out, science will have shown that it should in fact be reinstated as a planet, right? And we'll be back to this process. And finally, because it's very hard to interconnect people into communities and it's very slow to develop textbooks, this contributes to extremely high cost. And this is a really hot button issue today, that in some cases, students, for example, community college students' tuition is lower than the cost of their textbooks. So we have students who are dropping out of higher ed today because their books are more expensive than their tuition. We have third grade math students who there aren't enough textbooks to go around in their class, and they're having to share. So it'd be like SJ's on page 80 of the math text, and I'm on page 17, right? How are we going to be able to share textbooks? So I was really bothered by this, and what I was really lucky is that at the same time we were getting into open source software, and basically Connections was born out of realizing that we could combine the ideas of open source software, namely modularizing content, making it free, making it open, with textbooks. And so connections you can think of as a repository of not books, but really Lego blocks that build up books that are all free, that are all open licensed, so that anyone can be free to manipulate these, change them, add to them. And we're currently serving about 800,000 people per month through our site at cnx.org from just about every country that's connected to the internet. So it's been a really fun ride over the last 8 years or so. So hopefully that gives you a sense of where we are.
Great, thanks. And Eric, can you talk a bit about the collaborative process for production used by Wikipedia and how this is now being adapted by Wikibooks? And maybe give an overview of Wikibooks, because people probably aren't as familiar with that as they are with Wikipedia.
Sure. It's actually a very interesting process through which Wikipedia has produced several spin-off projects under the umbrella of the nonprofit Wikimedia Foundation. I mean, Wikipedia itself was based on wiki technology, which has been around since the mid-90s and which we basically just adopted for our own purposes to create an encyclopedia where anyone can collaborate and anyone can revise articles. And it quickly became clear that people wanted to do more with Wikipedia than write an encyclopedia. So they dumped in there the text of the constitution of an entire country, or they started writing dictionary entry, or they created a how-to manuals and all kinds of materials that we thought aren't really encyclopedic in nature. And so it was originally out of the desire of volunteers to create something that didn't belong in Wikipedia that we created other projects. And so we created a wiki dictionary and a wiki for source materials and a wiki for how-tos and manuals and textbooks. And so in 2003, the Wikibooks project was created, and it now has in the English language some 25,000 or so pages. And pages in this case can mean like 10 A4 pages, or it can mean one. It just means entries in the database. In practice, it's produced something like 50 books that they believe to be reasonably complete on a variety of subjects, ranging from lucid dreaming to physics. Everyone can write about anything that they want to write about, and the standards are pretty much the same as they are in Wikipedia. It's attempting to be reasonably neutral, comprehensive, factual, well-referenced, and so forth. So one of the challenges for us in the last couple of years has been to drive the project further to further success and make it possible to actually get the stuff out of there in a reasonable format so you can reuse it and you can actually use it in an educational setting, in traditional educational settings, as opposed to e-learning. And so we have recently worked with the Open Society Institute and with a German company called PediaPress. It's an interesting story in itself. There was this little website called PediaPress.com, which I came across one day, and it allowed you to just compile articles from Wikipedia into a book. So you could basically just select, I want this category or I want these articles, and then I want to download a PDF of it, or I want to order a printed copy. And so it was all closed source technology. It was they didn't talk to us. They don't have to, because we are open content, so they can just use our content if they want to. And so I called them and I said, well, this is really great stuff that you've created here. Are you willing to collaborate with us in some way? And they were. And so we have an agreement with them now that we're going to integrate their technology as open source into Wikipedia. And we're going to also use it to create wiki printable textbooks. And I can show a little bit of how that works on the screen later. But essentially, that's the direction that we're going. We want to make it easy for users to remix wiki materials, be they in Wikipedia or Wikibooks or any other of our repositories, into different formats, be it PDF, open document, which is what the Open Society Institute is funding, or other output formats, formats for learning management systems, and so forth.
Thanks, Eric. SJ, what's OLPC's interest in open educational materials, and how are they being used within your project?
So the idea behind One Laptop Per Child is to give students and teachers in all parts of the world the ability to collaborate and share materials that they make. And implicitly, that's only easy when they're using open educational materials and when they're making them. We're currently working in more than 15 languages, and just the localization problems involved when you have to contact publishers to get rights to make translations can be pretty overwhelming. OLPC has been has been committed to activities and interactions with children as much as the traditional notion of textbooks. And we've moved a little bit away from the notion of the text as the way that people learn things. The default interface on the laptops has icons for all of the activities that you can do. And some of them involve reading and some involve writing. And the traditional distinctions between the two, that you would use different activities and different programs for doing those, are hopefully a little bit foreign to people who've never encountered computers, never encountered creative tools. So we're very much committed to working with schools and teachers that haven't used these tools before to see them as publishing devices, as communication channels, and also as books and as libraries. And the open libraries that schools develop in some of our pilot countries, now including Nepal and Peru and Uruguay and Mongolia at some scale, they're particularly eager to communicate with other schools, and they usually don't share languages in common. In urban Peru, which is one of the countries that we're distributing right now, Spanish and even Quechua or Aymara, which are the big languages there, are often the second languages. People speak some local language first. They slowly learn one of those languages, and eventually they learn Spanish and English. And when they make things, they'd love to be able to share them with other people. There are a couple steps involved that someone else who's fluent in those languages has to take. And that's a very language-specific example, but I think with different audiences for the same material. For instance, the divisions that originally came up between dictionaries and books and encyclopedias and Wikipedia that caused people to split things out, those are also reframings and lenses into the same work that someone should be able to do. The original author shouldn't have to say, you know, I'm setting out to make a collection of essays or a novel or a history. They should just write what they know, share the materials they have, and have it incorporated into all those different works. So when you have the notion of individual authorship, rather than, especially for educational materials, where you're producing facts, mm-hmm. you're generating a way for people to learn. There shouldn't be 1,000 different creative ways for someone to learn that are so different that the person who came up with the idea has control over how it gets to be used. Really, what you're trying to do is convey to someone who doesn't know something a way to get there. You talked a little bit about the places where tuition is less than the cost of textbooks. In the rural and developing world, that's the case almost everywhere. People just don't have books. When they have books, it's not even the cost of the copyright that's the issue. It's just the cost of transmission. And in the last 10 years or so, we now have the ability to transmit an entire school's worth of books for the cost of the gas in a single truck that would have carried a load of materials to the school library. And now the only barrier left are these licensing barriers. So open education and open licensing is fundamental to giving these people libraries at all.
Right.
I would also add that the question of bridging disconnects and sort of bridging the disconnect between a teacher and a student, that's one that I at least think is a great place for students to be involved. Other students who have learned something are in a great position to teach and share one another. And that's something that this isn't so much a licensing issue, but a sharing issue. That's something that creating conversations around works is dramatically different from giving someone a work that is set and fixed. And you should read through all of it to know that you've learned something.
Right. Cool. Thanks, SJ. Rich, what's making this possible now? What makes open textbooks possible? Why is this coming together at this time?
Sure. Because we're seeing such excitement and growth in this area because really it's the convergence of three different sets of forces. I think the first really critical element in all of this is obviously technology, that the ability to provide and develop and distribute anywhere in the world free educational materials, it just is an impossibility in a print-based society. So that certainly the internet and the virtually free distribution of digital content is a very, very important part of this. And I think that something that a lot of people might not have thought about, but the exact same changes that are sweeping through the music industry today with digital download are beginning to sweep through the publishing industry and are going to be reinventing it in the very, very similar ways. And I think that this could come up later in some of the questions. The other really important part is again, this ability to create these Lego blocks. And I can just show, I think, a picture here. bring this up. This ability to create these Lego blocks of material and XML. How many people heard of XML? Critical. Wow, what a great response. Is an absolutely essential factor for building these reconfigurable, recombinable objects. So this is just one example of an object in Connections. And the really cool thing is that it looks like a web page. It looks like a regular, you know, it's got text, it's got pictures. But the neat thing is that this mathematics is actually not a picture of mathematics. This is actually encoded in something called MathML, where the computer actually understands that this is a function f of a variable t that equals a summation of a bunch of other functions. So you can actually cut and paste this into tools, all kinds of different mathematics tools like Mathematica, and this will actually work. So that you're starting to create books now that go far beyond anything you could do with paper, where each and every, where the book actually understands the mathematical formulae, the musical notation, the chemistry formulae within the book. Okay, this is extremely powerful. The second really important pillar is intellectual property and the development of licenses that mirror what the GPL and BSD licenses did for open software. And everyone here is probably familiar with the Creative Commons, show of hands. So there's probably not much point talking more about that. But that's been an absolutely essential part here. And then I think the last important pillar is the development of quality control mechanisms. And this is something that has just been emerging over the last 5 years or so. And that is that people are developing open repositories like the Connections repository like Wikipedia, Wikibooks, where anyone is allowed to contribute, but then there is a method by which we can control or vet the quality of materials. So that, and this is very, very important in an educational sphere, because it's very important to school districts, it's very important to universities, for example. So I know Eric is going to probably talk about wiki approaches later. But just one example here is this particular material, if you were to find it from a Google search, you have no idea of knowing whether this is high quality or not. But actually, we have a box over here for a construct that we call a lens. And what a lens is you can think of it as like a filter that sits up on top of our repository that lets individuals or organizations have control of it and point just to the materials that they think are useful or important. So this is my personal lens, right? So this is just the stuff that Rich Baranek thinks is cool or useful or that I use, okay? But there are all kinds of other lenses in Connections, including lenses from professional societies. The IEEE, the world's largest professional society, is now starting to vet the material within Connections for quality. And even companies like Texas Instruments, National Instruments here in Houston. And so I think that this combination of new technology, new intellectual property, and quality control that's really, I think, allowing these new kinds of books to emerge.
And while we're talking about Connections, can you mention a bit about print-on-demand options?
Oh, sure.
What
so
you're doing?
The other thing I think that's really important is if you can't produce these, right, as Eric said, people will not really take you seriously. The web is extremely important as a means to develop material and as a means to have free distribution. But in large parts of the world and with large communities, right, anyone over the age of 45, print is still very, very, very important. Okay, 45 should maybe certain communities. Maybe
are those the people using Connections material?
Yeah, maybe. So what we've actually developed over the last number of years is a print-on-demand capability. So here's an example of a collection within Connections. It's used around the United States in the K-12 for teaching music theory. And this is a collection of about 100 or so modules in Connections. But we have the ability, we have a rather sophisticated print-on-demand system that can actually spool the XML modules to create basically professional quality textbooks. And I can hand some of these around if people would like to have a peek. Just to give you an example, I think the exciting thing, these are assembled automatically. So here's the PDF, if you wanted to download just the PDF of this Introduction to Music Theory book. All the table of contents, the material, it's all scaled automatically. The index is generated automatically here at the end. I'll just keep scrolling through it. Just to give you an example of the power of print on demand, and I think Eric will talk about this as well. This is a textbook used at Rice as the sophomore level electrical engineering introduction textbook. This would be about $120 from a regular publisher. But using print on demand and the economies of scale that enables, this book costs students $20. So that's a six-fold, right, decrease in the price. And we're just very excited about the possibilities for print on demand. So I can hand this around if you want to look.
And Eric, could you talk a bit about the print on demand and projects which are being developed within Wikimedia?
Sure. Rich, can you?
Absolutely.
Thanks. So it's essentially the same thing. Actually, that will probably be a little bit painful. It's essentially the same thing that Rich just demonstrated with connections. We have the same capabilities. And if you go to wikieducator.org, which is not a Wikimedia project, but which is an affiliated project that we use to test experimental technologies, then you can see in the sidebar a feature called collections. And it does exactly the same thing that Rich just showed for connections. And so we're not in the development stage where we actually can do that on Wikipedia or Wikibooks yet, but that's the direction that we're going. So Wikieducator, by the way, is a very interesting project in its own right that tries to empower educators in developing nations to create educational resources. Are we on the right screen?
I think number one should work for you.
Well, can we just try it into yours?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just be less painful.
You can keep talking about it.
Sure. So I think we will probably go live on Wikibooks with the first print on demand in later this month as a pilot project. And then we'll see if it scales, because on Wikipedia we get something like 50,000 hits per second. So we have to be able to scale to that level of traffic with the technology. So we're going to try it on the Wikibooks scale, and if that works, we're going to try it on the Wikipedia scale. I have no screen, but that's okay. So what you see here in the left sidebar is the My Collection. Sorry.
Oh, I popped it.
This is painful. Is the My Collection, if you see that. And that's where you can add individual articles in a wiki to the collection. And so if I just go over here.
A little toy.
So this is an example collection that's just a tutorial on using wikis that they have developed over at Wikieducator. And I can load this collection into my collection manager, and then I can rearrange it, shift it around. If I'm logged in, I can save it, I can share it with other users, or I can do the expectable PDF thing. So it's sort of a mix and match tool for educational resources, and you can imagine that in the future we will not just be able to pull out of a single wiki, but out of multiple repositories and aggregate from connections, from Wikipedia, from Wikibooks, and from all these free educational resources to produce all kinds of education materials. I think one of the interesting challenges is going to be, if we're going to be so modular as Connections is, and as I think Wikibooks is becoming, then are we still going to have a good single thread that connects it all? Are we going to still use education methodology in the way we need to? And so I think another challenge, besides the whole mixing and matching of education resources, is the ability to actually, on top of that layer, educational methodology. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you do in that regard with Connections, but it's certainly a challenge. And I think the other thing that I wanted to say that with regard to the developments that we're seeing, I think we can essentially divide them into two major developments. And one is that education itself, the learning process is changing. The way we can use learning resources and interact with them is changing, like Samuel pointed out. You can interact with learning resources in a whole number of different ways. I said to you yesterday, Melissa, when I program in PHP and I go to the PHP documentation, then I always look at the commentary that's provided for every piece of documentation in there, and that's almost as valuable as the documentation itself, because people interact with the materials in new, interesting ways, and they provide examples, and they say, actually, this is inaccurate. And of course, in wiki books, you can even just edit a mistake if you see one. So the way education works is changing, and the way we interact with learning resources is changing. But at the same time, I think there's also a growing understanding, at least in our organization, that's the way we see it, that education is a public good. It's not something that should be proprietary. It's something that belongs to all of us. And I think the business models around education will die, frankly. I think what we're seeing right now is that the encyclopedias are going out of business one after the other. The French encyclopedia Quid, the German encyclopedia Brockhaus, which is not doing another print edition. They're going completely online. They are basically fading away. And of course, it's not just our fault that they are. It's the fault of the internet, if you will. It's the fault of the new engines of collaboration and sharing that civilization has created. And I think the same will happen in science, the same will happen in education, the same will happen wherever it is about knowledge and bringing knowledge to people. You can't profiteer from knowledge in the long run. I think that's the other trend that we're seeing.
I'd say that's one of the reasons I find print on demand to be distinctly unsexy. It's just you lose all of the things that currently make static works almost a disservice. I mean, how many people here have ever submitted a correction or gotten an update to one of your reference works or to a book that you learned from? I see maybe one hand all the way in the back. I mean, how many of you have found something that you thought was wrong? So it's just amazing to me that any publisher could be thinking about producing static texts in the future. I mean, even in the next couple of years. If you have the opportunity to have a print work, even if you made it yourself, now you have something that's rival. You can't just make extra copies and give it to your friends. There's no dialogue around it. You can't capture your annotations and pass them on. And there's no easy way for you to pull down an update. If you did it, you'd have to pay another $20 to get another book. So I know that people have, you know, they love print books, and I do too. And for things that don't get updated and that are works of art, it makes tremendous sense. For things that are a venue for exchanging knowledge that you know is going to change, I think it's not just a waste of money. It's also damaging to the environment, and it keeps people who find out that they think they have something to teach and they have something to say back to the author from being able to easily do that.
Rich, were you about to add something?
No, I just.
SJ, if we're talking about publishers now, do you see a role for publishers within this new learning environment in the future?
Certainly. And this should not be taken as a bad news for publishers.
Right.
I think that publishing houses have developed tremendous expertise in how to create their own lenses, how to provide editorial, how to make beautiful things out of the noise of updates and of input. And that's not something that it's easy for people to learn. That's the same skill that produces these beautiful print works now should be able to produce beautiful integration. But it involves changing some of those mid-level pieces of infrastructure that can be very difficult for large organizations. So I think publishers have to take this challenge very seriously and see themselves as the curators of knowledge for their readers, and not simply as the business, the business entity that monetizes an author's work. And I don't think most publishers see themselves as that, but there can be a conflict between those branches of a publishing industry. And there are a lot of the major publishers, probably all of them, are thinking about how they can do this and to what extent they should do this as a way of growing in the future. And something I find very, very encouraging is that all the major publishers I've talked to have said, yes, roughly, we know that some change like this has to happen. We're not sure yet how to do it, but we want to. They're investing in that. I probably, Rich, I know you have some specific experience.
Well, I could add some to that. I think that if you look at how the publishing industry is changing, it's changing much like the many industries before it, like the oil industry, like the music industry. It's becoming unbundled, and the different functions of a vertically oriented publishing company that does everything from acquisitions to actually, putting books on trucks and shipping them. These companies are basically starting to come apart, and they're starting to outsource more and more of their operations. And so I think that what we're going to see increasingly is vertically integrated publishers being replaced by specific companies that just do copy editing, just do great print on demand, just do shipping and handling. I think things like that. The other big, I think, potential area for publishers is in the areas of truly adding extra value to open materials. And I think this is where there's a very interesting and some might say dangerous interplay between for-profits and non-profits. But if you just ask how many people put Linux on their workstation or on their laptop by downloading it off the internet versus buying it from Red Hat, right? A very large percentage of people buy it from Red Hat. They pay $99. Why do they do that? They do that because Red Hat adds considerable value to that free distribution, extra code, extra support, and people are willing to pay for that. It's a value they're willing to pay for. And I think that we're going to see similar things in the future of companies taking open materials that are free and open licensed and then adding a lot of value to that material. And as a result, we're going to get some textbooks that aren't going to be completely free, but will be extremely low cost because people are only going to be willing to pay for that little increment for the extra value that's been added.
And speaking of publishers too, we also have the examples of the open access journals. And I exactly. think that some of the textbook publishers are beginning to look to the journals and seeing now we already have over 3,000 open access peer-reviewed journals and some of the largest publishing for the for-profit publishers are experimenting with open access journals like Springer and Elsevier. So I think that this is something which the textbook publishers themselves are beginning to study as well. Now, Rich, can you share with us some of the strategies that are needed to make open textbooks and learning materials a reality now?
I think this plays right into what you were just speaking about and the tremendous momentum in open access scholarly publishing that's been built up over the last number of years. Are people here familiar with the Budapest Open Access Declaration? Okay, you should be. BOAI.org, is that right? BOAI. We'll find the link. Anyway, that is basically a declaration of declaring that articles of scholarly communication in science, medicine, and engineering and other areas, that these should be open, licensed, and available for everyone to have free access to. And a tremendous victory in the last few months has been that the National Institutes of Health now in the United States actually is dictating that if you have NIH funding for a project, publications that come from that work over some amount of time need to be put into an open access format for free access. And so sort of keeping that in mind as a project that has been a huge success, a number of people in the open textbook world over the last year have realized that there's an opportunity to do a similar declaration and build a similar global community around the area of open textbooks. And so a number of these projects organized by OSI and by the Shuttleworth Foundation got together in Cape Town earlier this year to really discuss what are the core values behind all of these different open textbook projects. And we really realized that there was a tremendous consensus, not only in the background values of why we're doing what we're doing, but of our plan for where we'd like to take open textbooks in the future. So what has come out of this has been a declaration called the Cape Town Declaration that everyone needs to know about. So capetowndeclaration.org. And this is a declaration that was collaboratively developed by the people at this meeting. It has now been released to the world. It's been translated into a number of different languages. And I think what all of us would really urge you to do is go to capetowndeclaration.org, read the declaration, and then find out how you can get involved, right? And there's a number of ways. By signing the declaration, by getting your organization to sign on as a member or a supporting member, and by just finding a way for you to start contributing to open education. So I think all of us would like to invite everyone to check this out.
Right. And one of the basic strategies of the Cape Town Declaration is that all publicly funded educational materials should be freely available online. And this is already beginning to gain some ground in some pilot countries, which we're working in. We're beginning to work with the ministries of education in many countries. So by adopting open content licenses and mandating open access to the federally funded learning materials, hopefully this body of knowledge will continue to grow. So to take it up to the next level, SJ, with the open learning materials, how do you see the delivery of knowledge actually changing now?
Let me take in the other order. So delivery of knowledge, I mean, we're here talking about the future of textbooks, and how many people here are taking notes? It would be great to have a textbook on the future of textbooks. It'd be kind of retro to print it out and carry it with you and sort of flash it in people's faces when you meet with publishers. And I'm sure that everyone here has their own insights, comes from their own background. I'm sorry that I didn't see to setting up a collaborative editing session for the room. I usually love to do that. Subi to edit is one of my favorite tools anywhere. And the XOs have a little shared, you know, everyone gets their own cursor in a document. But I mean, I was doing this the other night. We were transcribing an Obama speech, and I'm not personally deeply into politics, but someone's like, we're doing collaborative transcription of a video. And I said, oh, that's awesome. And it feels so good to just be adding to a body of knowledge by contributing another piece that you know is going to be useful. So certainly the future of exchanging knowledge is that when you get a group of people together who are all thinking about the same thing, they should all be collaborating on the same thing. And a text shouldn't be something that one person sits down and spends 3 to 5 years editing and revising. It should be, you know, the slightly noisy result of you all sitting here for an hour, taking notes, sort of commenting, chatting with one another while you're taking notes, and producing something that needs an editor. And then a dozen of you who really care spend a little bit of time editing it. Someone posts it. You end up with a few blog posts. And then there's a place where people can go and see this body and slowly revise it down into a chapter that ends up being chapter 4 of the eventual book on, you know, the future of textbooks. That's where this should be going. And you can see just by the description of this process that if you then have to work out individual authorial rights for everyone sitting in this room, the overhead would just be tremendous. And it would be a little ridiculous. So I see that these are small steps that we're taking in open education, saying, all right, take what exists now and get those people to start buying into this idea. And at the same time, there's this huge influx, and there's really a flood of knowledge that is textbook quality knowledge that's coming in from other sources. We were talking last night about how a lot of people actually read Wikipedia instead of their textbooks because it's more interesting, it's better linked. It's not phrased the same way. They have to construct the arguments in their own head, but they can follow up on any detail they want. Those are going to meet at some point in the middle. And I think what guides the meeting is how easy it is to do these large scale, to carry out sharing at a large scale, one person sharing with 1,000 people.
Right. And to follow up on that, it seems that within the open education movement that we're beginning to see a breakdown or a change in the boundaries of what we think of as a writing form, so an encyclopedia, a dictionary, a textbook. And how do you see this playing out? I know that both Eric and Rich have thought a lot about this. So,
do you want to start?
Sure. So I think it's interesting that copyright essentially creates a friction. I can't take the material in the textbook and reuse it for a different purpose. The moment you eliminate that friction or reduce it by using a liberal license, that moment you enable all kinds of use scenarios that weren't possible before. So that moment it actually does become possible to embed the dictionary into the encyclopedia in the textbook, or everything into everything. And so that moment, it only remains a technical challenge to do that and no longer a political or social challenge to do that. And so I think it is an inevitability that we will see tools being developed for the interaction between learning repositories, for the remixing between learning repositories, and that the end result will be that to you as a learner, it doesn't actually matter where the stuff comes from and through what process it has been created. All that matters is to what extent you want to use it, what do you want to do with it. So what SJ said earlier, the notion that you create different views on learning resources is exactly right. I don't think that's something you achieve by creating a wiki for everything or a learning resource for everything. I think that's something you achieve through open APIs, by defining open standards for interchange formats and so forth. And then as a learner, you can just draw from that. And I think what happens then is that you eliminate unnecessary inefficiencies. There are something that you could call necessary inefficiencies. For example, Wikipedia is written from what it calls a neutral point of view. If you were to write an encyclopedia and you wanted to write it from a conservative Christian point of view or from a political leftist point of view, then that's a necessary inefficiency that you actually have to do that. You can copy the content and use it as the basis for something that's biased in one way or another, but you have to do that. But then there are the unnecessary inefficiencies that you have four encyclopedias writing the same biography, trying to be neutral, that you have six textbooks writing, trying to uncover the same ground in physics, trying to follow the same roughly methodology. And those inefficiencies will go away as people who share the same standards and views just come together to collaborate around them. And again, that's something that can only happen the moment you take copyright out of the picture and make it an open access environment, and the moment you take the profit motive, frankly, out of the picture and make it an environment where people just want to come together in order to achieve something for the public good.
My points would really be, I think, summarizing these. That when I think about the future of open textbooks, there's really three dimensions that I think are very important. And the first, and it's really about blurring along those dimensions. And one is the people dimension and the people's roles. In today's society, we have a very rigid roles of teacher, student, author. And these roles are not mixed, and we're increasingly moving into a world, as SJ was saying, where these roles really are becoming mixed. I have students in my senior level class at Rice that are developing material for juniors, and frankly, they're better at teaching the juniors than I am because they can remember what it was like to be a junior, right? Because it was last year. So I think that the blurring of roles is really critical. The second is the blurring of lines between content that just we've developed over the last, say, 1,000 years, these bins or containers that we classify material in: encyclopedia, dictionary, textbook, novel. And I think that we're starting to see these lines being blurred absolutely by these new forms of developing content. But I think the third one, and this is to go back to what SJ was talking about a few minutes ago, is really context, and the fact that when you pick up a textbook today, it's really devoid of very much context. It's not personalized. It's one size fits all, like when you go in and buy a suit right off the rack. And we're moving into a world where these books now can be personalized so that every person can have their own customized learning experience that connects into who you are. Right, that you grew up in Iowa in the 50s and you liked, farm tractors, right? That knowing that, you can teach people much, much more effectively. And then I think that the other thing that SJ brought up is the idea of marginalia, that the notes around the material are increasingly becoming as important as the material itself. And this is just something that has been, impossible until the recent times. I think it's these three dimensions together that are enabling us to, I think, invent a completely new way of conveying educational knowledge to people.
I would just disagree with calling that marginalia. And I think the profit motive is great. I think that people should practice becoming really good at being transmitters and trainers and guides. It just makes no sense to be trying to control the underlying property. People who engage themselves as physical trainers, they're not carrying out a routine that you can't find. You can get all the knowledge of what they're going to do with you, but nevertheless, you can become a very respected and well-paid and sought-after trainer because you're good at the social engagement that gets someone to actually exercise. And it's no different with learning and education. So claiming that the only way that you can make a great living or become a superstar or become an internationally renowned author is by being the only person who can then touch your work, especially when it's educational work, that's misguided. And I guess we have to switch to questions soon. But before we do, I was kind of serious about pulling people's notes together. If anyone wants to send me notes, I'm just sj@laptop.org. And I'll write everyone back with a little summary sometime tomorrow.
Well, it seems you already have one question in terms of addressing the language issue and how open learning materials are adaptable. And you've had much experience in this, SJ, with your work.
That's true. That's an important piece of adaptation. I do think of it as the same as translating something written for adults into something for children, or translating something written for businessmen into something for open source aficionados. And it's the art of matching underlying knowledge to an audience. There's an art involved that's different from capturing information that is really valuable. But there are communities. The interesting thing is that there are these pools of hundreds of thousands of people skilled at writing and editing and translating and rewriting these things, and they love contributing their knowledge to everyone for free. The question is, how do you tap into that? When you make something new, how do you announce it?
And you're doing some work in Mexico around this already, aren't you?
Yes. Well, we have a group in Mexico that is taking a lot of English language map material and turning it into a Spanish language map and a collection of geography lessons that teaches you about all the different facets of the world. And they're able to do it building on an open source stack and building on freely available place names. But I think projects like OpenOffice have done more to say, hey, let's get 70 language teams together and go to it.
Right. Wikimedia has done work in this area.
I mean, whenever I look at a collaborative project of any kind, and I look at the website and I don't see the 70 languages at the top, then I kind of think, okay, they don't have a clue what they're doing. Because really, if you don't make multilinguality a key part of what you're doing and you're trying to collaborate around education, you're doing something very wrong. In Wikimedia, we started out by opening up to all the languages that people were interested in contributing in, and now we have over 250, and it's created an amazing movement around it. And so we have chapter organizations, kind of grassroots organizations, popping up in different countries. We now have them in over 15 countries around the world that support the Wikimedia mission. And they wouldn't have been possible without that commitment to do multilinguality. And the same is true in the projects. Like, our chief technology officer might never have joined us if it weren't for the fact that we have Wikipedia in Esperanto. So it's kind of fun, because opening multilingually in multiple languages truly does open you up to other cultures and to contributions from many, many different countries. And in our software, that's been true as well. So what we've done is we've created this, we as being this volunteer community, not the organization, have created this elaborate internationalization infrastructure. So when you write code for MediaWiki, which is what our software is called, and you commit it to our version control system, the translators will immediately start jumping on it and translate it into 20 languages, which is just amazing. Or whenever you really put out anything, the translators will jump on it. They love doing that kind of stuff. So I should add that in terms of the actual multiple languages of Wikipedia, Wikibooks, and so on, it's not translations. Mm-hmm. It's people writing it from scratch in their own language with their own cultural background.
Cool. I know we could go on, but I'd like to take the first question, if we could.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah, it works.
I write for Telluride, an organization that covers academic publishing and ebook publishing. And I'm generally enthusiastic about the idea of open textbooks, but there is a chaos involved. And I think that people searching for tutorials or textbooks want to have the best. They want to have a way to evaluate what is in its finished state and what's not in its finished state. I mean, and speaking of Wikibooks in particular, there are, there's several good textbooks there, but there are several textbooks that were started, never got launched. And to me, it seems that we need to have a better way of evaluating the textbooks that are out of there. And one other thing, signal-to-noise ratio is a big issue. It seems that education, instruction, it's not people can explain how to do things, but you're looking for the most efficient and effective way to do things. And I, as a web surfer, want to find the most efficient way to learn something.
Okay, Rich, do you want to start?
Sure, I could jump. So I kind of explained. So we exactly share your point of view about how do we find finished material. How do we find material that is high enough quality? And so that's why really we have in our particular repository, we have it's a completely open repository for anyone to contribute. And so there's stuff in there that is unfinished. There's stuff in there that's fantastic. So the question is, how do you go through this and sift out the really good stuff? So the standard way to do this would be some kind of universal review process, like a publishing company does today. The problem with that is that that doesn't scale to a huge repository of potentially millions of items that are changing constantly. So what we have adopted is this, what we call a lens architecture, which is this layer on top of the repository. And so when you go to if you're looking for a material in let's say, signal processing, and you go to connections, you will actually see materials that have the IEEE logo. And IEEE is the most trusted vetter of content in that particular area. They're developing a peer review procedure that is a mirror of their regular peer review procedure. And so what the idea is to try to bring the best of both worlds, the best of standard peer review-like procedures with the advantage of open content development.
Can you use a lens from connections for things that are outside connections?
So in fact, this is in the next release. Absolutely, we'll be able to point and be able to basically filter out material from other parts of the internet as well. And so I think that this can be solved, but it does require some, you know, technology, and it does require people to volunteer to conduct this review. So it still
Great.
Takes some.
It seems
work.
Like we have a lot of questions.
Yeah,
should we move on to the next
maybe
one?
We could take three questions at once, and then.
If you guys are
multiplex,
are you comfortable with
or
that?
We could probably just do them one.
Yeah, let's just do them one by one and try to go quickly. Yeah.
Hi, I was actually sort of indirectly quoted by our esteemed colleague, Mr. Mueller, over there previously. And the story I'd like to tell is roughly in my early college days, I attempted to build a French verb conjugator in Java, which is sadistic. And as I tried to work with it, I got stymied by a very simple problem, which was, how do I make buttons with accents on it? It turns out to be quite important in the French pronunciation. And so I put that away. I didn't do anything with it. And 10 years later, I came back to do it, but this time in a different language. And the same problems are still there. The only thing that got better was Matsumoto-san's production of Ruby, which allowed me a lot more flexibility than what Java did. So for anyone who's actually trying to produce multilingual content or things that bridge the multilingual gaps, the tools are embarrassingly primitive. If somebody asked me to explain UTF-8 encoding, I'd have to pull out a binary calculator and explain, you know, that so many bits get consumed here and this is how a code page works. It's not simple to produce multilingual content. And I think I would like to see, I mean, you can't just highlight and cut and paste so many E's and accents. It's just not effective. It's not scalable. I feel like almost there needs to be like a meta structure or a meta programming layer for producing multilingual content more quickly. Fortunately, TextMate has some ways to do that, and Emacs has always been extendable. But we need extensible ways to encourage multilingual people to produce multilingual content or cross-lingual content more rapidly. Do you have solutions in the pipeline or that, or do you have any sort of feelings on that? I feel SJ probably has some experience in the field.
I don't know. I would turn that over to Eric. I would say from our perspective, we use standard translation tools. We use Poodle, and we're still using PO files as an intermediary. There's no question that the whole realm of translation infrastructure needs to be made much simpler and better unified across the different communities, each of which currently has their own tool chain and has a pretty hard time dealing with others.
So actually, I can show something. And it's a wiki that we use in Wikimedia. Yeah. And it's called the Translate Wiki. And it's a fairly recent development. So it used to be that every translation of the software was done directly in code, or as SJ said, through what's called PO files, which are translation files that you can share and then import. And now we have something called the Translate Wiki, where people actually collaborate on all the translations of the user interface of our software. So there's bounties that we give to people who we, again, being the community, not the Wikimedia Foundation, that we give to people who contribute languages. So This is called the Language Project, and this is specifically targeting languages in countries like South Africa. It's targeting languages like Swahili. And so you have to translate the key messages of the user interface, and then you can collect a bounty. And so it has been translated into, I think, 3 African languages fully as a result of this this project, this initiative. And so my answer would be, the moment you open up the guts of whatever the project mm-hmm. is in order to allow people to collaborate on the internationalization, both in terms of the code as well as in terms of the messages, that moment your project will be able to scale. Do not even begin to try to solve these problems yourself. Again, yeah. This is the reason why this can just not thrive in a proprietary competitive form. It just can only thrive if people collaborate. Obviously, you can be sort of semi-collaborative, and that's what Gmail is trying to do when they say, you know, please give us free interface transactions for Gmail. And they did, and they succeeded in doing that, and that can work. So you can be sort of collaborative around the languages. But if you're starting to be collaborative around the languages, why not be collaborative around the whole product? And so that's worked quite well for us, I would say.
We have about 5 minutes left, so let's go for more questions.
Yeah. One of the things textbooks do is simplify complex areas of knowledge. How do you deal with differences of opinion when you get beyond knowledge, whether it be, you know, politicized issues like creationism and global warming to, you know, valid academic issues like causes of civil war, causes of the Great Depression, or even, you know, what scientists currently believe cause cancer, which evolves, year to year?
So, I'll give an answer from my personal perspective, as far as connections, which is that we decided not to develop a wiki model where there is one single entry, canonical entry for any concept or idea, and instead we have a multiple entry model. So for the civil causes of the Civil War, we can have an unlimited number of entries. And not only that, authors' names are actually associated with those entries. And we actually encourage, you know, contributions from academics and are able to give them, you know, rich statistics on who's using their stuff. So I think that is an important issue of how to deal with multiple different points of view under these different kind of editing models. So we have basically decided that we will allow an unlimited number and then use lenses to point people towards either the most used or the ones that have been peer reviewed.
I like the wiki model, but I'll say it's tough.
Yeah.
Next question.
Hi, I'm an instructional designer in corporate education, and my job is really to take what I see as raw content and figure out, you know, what the learning objective is and the best way to deliver that content. And I love the sort of wiki and shared content model because of the contextual aspect of it. But what I see missing, and I'm curious to see how, you know, the feature might incorporate this, is a lot more of visual representations of content. So, you know, you take engineering principles, for example, one of the best ways to teach it might be through some animation or visualization of that. So what do you see happening in the future, or what needs to happen to start to bring in more of those perspectives, people who can do that and share that with the world?
I can say something. I think we showed text, and maybe we shouldn't have showed text, but in any of these platforms, it can be as multimedia as you want. You can embed any kind of flash, video, other kinds of interactive tools. Mm. You want to mention something?
Sure. So, I mean, we have a media repository. It's called Wikimedia Commons, that's feeding all of our projects in the Wikimedia universe, and it contains more than 2 million files, most of which are images, and all of them are freely usable for any purpose, you know, just like Wikipedia itself. And that includes a lot of really nice illustrations that serve educational purposes. I mean, unlike Flickr or any of the other YouTube or any of these repositories, it's strictly educational in nature, so it has to resonate with the actual projects. But interestingly, I would say that it's actually somewhat harder to collaborate around things like illustrations, because mm-hmm. you can easily chunk it into tiny little pieces. Right. So
But there are some tools that do it. I mean, if you want to know, come talk to us after.
I mean, one thing that has helped us tremendously is an application that's called Inkscape, and it's an open source vector graphics drawing application that you should actually know about, I think, because it's quite influential, at least in our community, and it has directly led to the contribution of thousands and thousands of illustrations. So the moment the authoring tools themselves become freely available and freely usable, that means volunteers will contribute more materials. And we use SVG as a vector graphics open standard so people can share the materials on different platforms and collaborate around them. The other thing that I should mention is that the foundation received in the last year a donation of $20,000 that was specifically earmarked as being only used for the purpose of creating illustrations for our projects.
Thank you, Philip Greenspan.
Yeah, Philip Greenspan is the donor who donated this money. And so we set up a process, a volunteer in this case, set up a process where people can submit basically proposals for illustrations that are missing in Wikipedia and the other projects. And then, again, it's a bounty process where people then can claim the bounty the moment they contribute an illustration. I think we're going to see the combination of these bounty models or funding models for freely licensed content within these open communities for the missing gaps, for the pieces that volunteers don't contribute.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll be up here and welcome any questions that you may have. And if you could fill out the feedback cards, which have been distributed, that would be great. And I'd like to thank all of our panelists. And good. Thank you.